again.
Okay, start over again. What was that, Rod?
The Bo-Katan thing. We had this huge multimedia show, which had parts of slides, lots of slides, lots of video/films, as well as live actors and people at Altos doing various sundry things that would get projected hugely onto these huge screens and stuff. And so the idea was that every year Xerox had this one conference where we get together as top 200 executives from around the world and bring them in one place. And so they always had it at some place like the Boca Raton Hotel and Club.
Right.
And so we put on this huge show for them. And then afterwards, they were all required to come through the suites that we had set up for more one-on-one contact with all this stuff. So we took 25 plus or minus Altos and early laser printers and all kinds of stuff down there and did this huge show for them and then the thing afterwards with the idea the top Xerox management actually got it and knew what Xerox needed to do to turn the corner. And so this was their attempt to get everybody else to buy into it, all the people who only knew about selling black boxes
for Xerox machines. What did they understand?
Nothing. As it turned
out. What I mean is, what did the top management get?
Oh, the top management got the fact that they were sitting on a potential gold mine and really believed in the historical changes that were sort of in the stuff that we were trying to come up with and develop at the time and thought that, you know, saw that that was going to be a huge, humongous business opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
But the people who only knew how to sell black boxes didn't really understand things like systems and stuff like that. They knew how to peddle individual boxes, and anything other than individual boxes was a threat to them. And so despite the fact that they tried to do that, and we spent, I don't know how many millions of dollars to do this thing, Ellenby could tell you how much it was, I'm sure, because he had control of the budget. They just didn't get it, and so things sort of gradually petered down from there.
And then Steve Jobs, like 6 months later or something, in 79, came for the demo of the Alto and set the systems at par.
And then, of course, everything else around has all kind of gone that way. I mean, back then, you know, we were certainly the only people doing something like Ethernet. And, you know, all of the RS-232 people and all of that thought we were nuts, or at least told everybody that we were. And so, there was a lot of stuff that could have gone quite differently had the corner have been turned at that meeting, which was what the original intent of it was.
And there was really nothing that could have been done to persuade?
I'm not sure, because the management at Xerox, and when you say management, you have to get down to this level of, you know, 200 different vice presidents of different pieces of Xerox and stuff. It needed to be a bottom-up push, and those guys were the blockade right there. The very, very top guys got it, but it was all the guys underneath in the middle that actually had literal control of things like budgets and how you did things and how you did sales and marketing.
People have told me that the simplicity of selling a copier and consumables and service versus a system like this, which was really complex. And
well, even when we were literally doing that with selling stars and stuff, it's a whole different sales mode that you need to be in. You need to be in a systems mode and actually understand. And you know, selling a Xerox machine was really not terribly different from selling toothpaste, really. And so all of those people were, you know, classical marketers.
And the is catching a little bit more here. In the meantime, all of the little home built kits and Apple IIs and whatever were coming up, and they all had their little killer apps like spreadsheets, and they were pretty cheap, and they were just populating.
Yeah. Actually, one of the things I failed to mention when you were showing me around down there when we were looking at the K Pro and the Grid and I'm gone brain dead. The other one right next to it there.
Yeah.
We did an early one of those at Park as well, called Note-Taker.
Note-Taker.
Yeah, which essentially had very similar form factor, actually little. And essentially it was
one in display at the museum.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. It's essentially an Alto, in, you know, a portable Alto essentially.
With a character-based screen.
Yeah. And actually, one of the guys I was pointing out in a couple of the pictures, Doug Fairburn, was the principal designer on that.
On the note taker.
Yeah, and he had worked with Lynn Conway and whatnot. And Doug ended up being one of the founders of VLSI.
We know the story of that Alan Kay was somehow transporting a note taker on a flight, and he sat next to Adam Osborne.
Oh, really?
And then Adam looked at this thing and said, holy.
That's a legend.
I don't know if that's true, but...
It seems
plausible.
Likely. Yeah, certainly plausible. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, sort of the analog of the Steve Jobs visit to Park.
Yeah, it was. And so the Dolphin, the D0EM09, we've got John Wick's Dolphin. Mm-hmm. That was, you were involved in stitching all of those together?
We built all of the, we didn't stitch weld the boards. The boards came to us already stitch welded. But we did the assembly and test of the early D0s. Now, up until that one, we're probably still being hand-built at Park, and it was a little later on when the group that I was in, SPG, or the Special Programs Group, which is the group that did all the Altos and Dovers.
And the 1100s after that.
Yeah, and then we did the sort of next generation of those as well. Down in El Segundo, and then later on there was yet another version of the Dolphin that became one of the product versions of the Dolphin that was actually built in a little shop actually up in Palo Alto, a shop that they called the Garage.
Oh, okay.
That some friends of mine started up, and I spent a lot of time up there too, but it was down the street a ways from Park itself.
And the guy that made the mouse that had the two wheels?
Jack Halley. Yeah. Jack Halley's Mouse House up in Berkeley, and Jack and a couple of guys that work for him, basically in some combination of Jack's kitchen and garage, machined and built all of the mice.
So the two-wheeled one, and then eventually they came up with the ball mouse.
The first ones that I was familiar with were the ones that it looked a lot like the ball mouse that we were looking at earlier. From the top, but on the bottom there were actually two wheels, one running horizontally, one running vertically. And that's where you got your XY axis out of that. And so those were a little on the temperamental side, but they worked just fine. And then later on, Jack came up with the idea and invented essentially the way to do it with the ball and the sensors inside in order to be able to track which direction the ball was moving. And the difference between the wheel mouse and the ball mouse was phenomenal in terms of the end user. Although you became very good at moving a wheeled mouse around as well, but a ball mouse was clearly better.
Clearly better. And the guy that came up with the technology for the 1 megabit, 3 megabit Ethernet, what was his name?
Well, there was a combination of guys. Bob Metcalf was, of course, essentially the inventor, and I think has his name on most of the patents associated with it.
Yeah.
But David Boggs worked with him as well. And then there was a guy by the name of Tat Lamb who was more of an analog kind of guy. And so Tat did all of the original transceivers and came up with, well, I'm not sure who came up with it, but Tat built the tap blocks and the tapping tools, the custom tapping tools that you needed to be able to tap the coax and whatnot. So certainly the combination of Metcalf, Boggs, and Tat Lamb were certainly key there. Later on, as I remember, the D0 and probably Dandelion Ethernet boards were done by Ron Crane and Roy Ogus, because I remember debugging the first, I think it was the first D0 ones up at Park with particularly Ron and Roy.
And you saw that moment where there was this great spool of cable and they were...
Yeah, I was up at Park in the lab one day working with, I think, Chuck Thacker, and Boggs and Metcalf and Tat Lamb came in and soldered a couple big several watt 50-ohm transistors, 50-ohm resistors on either end of the coax, and tapped it and actually shot a signal down. And so it was my understanding always that was the first actual signal from an Ethernet, and it was a roll of RG8 sitting on the floor. So that was kind of cool, and they had already been working on the Ethernet board for the Alto, so it wasn't long before Altos all had Ethernet boards in them, and in fact were always all networked together, as they were when we were doing tests for them down in El Segundo. They were all networked together with coax I had running around either on the floor or hanging from pipes overhead.
So you had the red boxes or the cream-colored boxes?
They were all cream-colored. Well, actually, the earliest on ones were just plain metal, and then all of the 3 megabit production ones, to my knowledge, were all the cream colored. My guess is the red ones that you've showed me a couple of were probably essentially second generation or 10 meg Ethernet instead of 3 meg Ethernet. And they, my guess, and it seems logical, is that they probably painted those red so that they would be evident when you were up in the ceiling with what flavor transceiver you were messing with.
And I think the Dorado was 10 megabit Ethernet,
yeah.
10 MIPS, and a 10 meg hard drive. It was like that was what they were aiming for in the Dorado.
Well, at least the Dorados that I remember actually had Trident disks inside of them. That's one of the things that made them hugely noisy and not terribly good office machines. And so a lot of them ended up down in the machine room with super long cables going up to somebody's...
Right.
But yeah, and then they did these incredible enclosures to try to quiet them down that they put around them, which of course I'm sure created some real heat problems. But yeah, they had T80 or perhaps even some with T300 disks inside them.
I remember it when I was at Park and visiting Park in the 80s, there were Dorados in racks, and there was...
And then you'd see some in the hallways. You probably wouldn't see one in somebody's office, but you see some, and they were in the huge cabinets to try to muffle them.
I think Dave Boggs actually had a Dorado in his office. That was Ken Pierce. I think he must have been one of the few that would have it in his office.
Wouldn't be surprised.
And you were saying that possibly the last Alto at Park was a network server.
I believe that it was, I think we called it the popcorn server, if I'm remembering correctly. And it was the server that essentially was the standard of time for all of Xerox. So all of Xerox, all of their machines that needed to use the time protocol, I forget what the XNS time protocol was called now, but maybe it was just XNS time protocol, all came to that Alto at Park to find out what time it was.
That's great.
Yeah, Altos were actually pretty good at keeping time as opposed to later machines like PCs, which were notoriously not so good at keeping time.
And the Altos were first unsocketed, and then they became, you designed them as socketed, but it pushed the UMC up, but they were much, you regained that on the repair and test.
Just maintainability. One of the things that was real key in the redesign from the Alto 1 to the Alto 2 was to significantly increase the maintainability. And having sockets on the individual boards certainly did that, both during manufacturing and manufacturing test, and then in maintenance over the years, being able to take a shot at what individual chip might be causing a problem and swapping it out on a socket board rather than trying to unsolder and solder a new chip in and end up ultimately 12 chips later finally finding the chip that was causing the problem. So at least with sockets you didn't have to throw away, which things that in those days, if you had 4 AND gates on a chip, that was still a pretty darn expensive chip.
So you'd pull it out of the socket and you'd still have a working chip in your hand.
A working chip that you could plug into another board. And you could always, at that point too, have a stash of known to be working perfect boards that were your mother set that you could take chips out of to help you troubleshoot the ones that weren't working.
Whereas with the Alto 1, sometimes you have 2 perfectly working Alto 1s, and you swap boards from each to the other.
And there would be some boards that just resisted fixing no matter what. And so what I would do with those is usually about every month or month and a half, I'd tuck all of the boards that I had sort of given up, at least temporarily, on, tuck them under my arm and go up to Park and spend a few days sitting with Chuck Thacker in the lab troubleshooting boards. And Chuck would be writing, you know, custom programs to try to troubleshoot the particular problem that any particular board, you know, stuff that was way beyond my capabilities of being able to do. And we'd usually be pretty successful in fixing boards, but I remember one time in particular that was pretty funny, where Chuck would usually show up at about 10 o'clock in the morning, and we started working on this one Alto 1 control board, which had just caused me fits, and I just couldn't figure out how to fix it. And so we worked and worked and worked on that. Chuck wrote all these custom microcode programs to try to troubleshoot it. And we worked on that board until probably 10 o'clock that night for probably 12 hours. Finally, Chuck yanked it out of the extender board, literally threw it on the ground, and then jumped up and down on it with both feet, and then calmly looked at me and said, "There, now we don't have to fix that one." And so that was just the way that it went with Alto 1 boards sometimes. You just had to give up on them. After a while, they just could not be made to work. And so that was certainly one of our design goals when our group in El Segundo did the Alto 2 redesign, was to make them much more maintainable than Alto 1s.
So what do you think is the great legacy of the Alto series?
I guess it would be tough for me to try to pick any one thing, because there were so many things that trace their roots in some way, shape, or other back to Altos. I think the whole idea, well, many years later, Sun had a marketing catchphrase that they used that basically said, "The network is the computer." Mm-hmm. And I think the Alto really did that first. And I think that, although we may not have said it quite that way, I think that was certainly the philosophy of Altos, and the idea of networked machines and other systems to play with those machines, principally things like laser printers and file servers and stuff
like
that.
And I guess the idea of visual interfaces and...
Oh, certainly, was a natural...
Bravo approach. And
but,
SIL.
But the
and...
fact that you had these tools that individually were good for the individual user, but the real power of the system was the fact that it was just a piece of a network.
Of a network.
So it was just a node. It was just a node.
Well, thank you, Ron Cude, for this quick interview. And now we're going to start packing up an Alto 2XM and other various Xerox things from the DigiBarn to go over for tomorrow's October 11, 2003 Vintage Computer Festival Alto 30th Birthday Bash, for which a birthday cake is being made at Albertsons.
Yeah. Birthday Cake Central. Do you actually know John Schock, who's going to be on your panel tomorrow?
I don't, and what, John may have
one of the things
pulled
that
out. I'm not sure.
One of the things we were just talking about, networks and stuff, one of the things I remember that John did, which may well have been the earliest instance of that, is he helped design and build a worm.
Yeah.
That basically, you know, would go from Alto to Alto, and when it found one with some spare cycles, would execute a little bit here and then, you know, move to the next.
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. And so John was involved with that sort of stuff. Really,
He emailed me saying, "You know, I cannot find any code. I don't have a disk. I don't have listings. I cannot find any code for that worm."
Yeah.
So that worm will probably not live again. But you're right. If you can have worms or things like that in a network computer system, it is a networked system.
Yeah. Well, and even down to the level of memory chips still failed a lot back in those days. And one of the things we put in Alto 2s to help that was error correction. But you still wanted to know about broken memory chips. And so whenever an Alto wasn't running, it ran a program called DMT, the Diagnostic Memory.
Right, that was in the book.
I remember what the T stood for.
Yeah.
Diagnostic Memory Test, of course. And and you could walk, and so any Alto after N minutes of idleness would automatically go into DMT, and there'd just be a little cursor bouncing around on an otherwise black screen, and you could walk up and hit the S key to get the status, and it would tell you how much memory it was testing and what its last address was and exactly which chip was bad,
right,
if there happened to be one. Well, it also, after a while, there was a version of DMT that would broadcast that information over the Ethernet periodically, and so you could have another Alto set up to collect that information. And so you could, you might have 200 Altos in your network. You could walk in the morning and on one Alto see the memory reports from all night long on all the other Altos and know, oh, I have to go into Bruce's machine and replace such and such a chip this morning. And so that was probably, you know, one of the first instances of any sort of networked automated diagnostic facility, too.
Wow.
So, I mean, even down to that level, there were things that were being written for the Alto that just seemed like a natural thing to do, but were actually quite revolutionary, really.
And of course, all the, I know that Alto served as spell check servers.
Oh, yeah.
You needed a dedicated machine, and of course.
So there was a lot of really interesting things going on with them that you just accepted as a natural extension of a way of life that was beginning to seem quite natural.
Yeah, and that would have been about 76 or so. When do you think the network really came alive at Park?
Well,
I know Alto went into production in 73.
Yeah, it was before that because.
By 74, there must have been a number.
By 74, there were probably at least 20 or 30 machines networked at Park. And if I remember correctly, I think we did something on the order of maybe 120 Alto ones over several different builds, probably four or five different builds. So that was probably over easily a two-year period. And then we worked on the redesign for the Alto 2, and I don't remember off the top of my head, although we could probably find it written somewhere when the first Alto 2s actually started shipping. I would guess more like 75 or 76.
And the XM?
Maybe even 77.
The XM was?
Well, there were two things. Let me try to remember. If I'm remembering correctly, Alto 1s used 1K memory chips. Alto 2s used 4K, and Alto 2 XMs used 16K. So that gave you up to 512K of memory in each Alto 2. The other change for an Alto 2 XM was the addition of a second disk drive to give you expanded disk capability. Although the
XM might have stood for
expanded memory.
Right,
exactly.
In both senses of the word.
In both senses, both literal memory and disk memory. And then even though the disk drives, the disk packs and the disk drives were capable of 2.5 megabytes of storage, that seemed like an awful lot of storage back in those days. 512K of memory seemed like an awful lot of memory back in those days. And as would happen, people tended to collect disk packs for different uses and whatnot over time. But if you would walk into anybody's office and they had, say, I think anyone with more than 10 disk packs was considered way out on the lunatic fringe because, oh my God, who would ever possibly need as many as 10 2.5 meg disk packs? That's just ridiculous to think that anyone would need more than 20 or 25 meg of storage.
Yeah.
At their hands. They could swap the disk back in. But,
right.
Yeah, that was pretty incredible to think about it. Once you sort of reached 10 or more disk packs, then you were considered out on the lunatic fringe.
I remember Park in the 80s, walking the hallways, there were these disk packs leaning that people had just sort of left in their offices. They'd stopped using the Alto.
Well, one of the things that we found is that if you disk packs weren't all that widely seen, and so the computer accessories people for a long time hadn't quite made anything to store that flavor of disk pack. But what we quickly found is that old magnetic tape holders, just with nice little metal prongs vertically, made absolutely wonderful disk pack holders. And so people would have the shelves in their office lined with these tape holders, but they'd have disk packs in them instead.
Right.
So that they'd all be stacked nice and vertically and neatly next to each other.
And you were saying that people played Maze War between what locations?
Well, one of the things that always happened is since we had some star development people in El Segundo, El Segundo was really the first place that we had a quote-unquote high-speed, i.e. 9.6K, telephone line to for communications. And so one of the things that usually happened on almost a daily basis after 5 or 6 o'clock was mass games of maze wars breaking out between people in Palo Alto and El Segundo. And then predating that, even back in the strictly Alto and 3-meg days, especially in parts of Park and ASD, which was the group I was in, which was physically in Palo Alto, but in a different building from Park itself, it was down on Hanover Street, were games of track over the net that were just brutal.
Well, you know,
but that was all within the same building.
One of the Maze War guys who wrote, helped write the PDS, IMLEX PDS 1 version, had this memo. He came out and he had this box of stuff, and this memo was sent around 75 or 76, and it was from some administrator, top administrator for ARPANET, to Park, saying, you know, dear people, Maze War is using up to half the packets on ARPANET, and we request you to restrict its use to off hours.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember there being a restriction that said, hey, don't play Maze Wars until after hours.
Yeah, and so in a sense, you look at the modern, so-called modern internet, and of course you have massive multiplayer games, and you have file sharing, all that, and you have the boring document stuff, the web stuff, and it's that same duality of real-time, fast interactivity versus the business at hand of the document.
Yeah, and keeping in mind, too, that back in those days, 9600 baud was a high-speed line.
Yeah, I think the entire ARPANET was on two 64K leased lines in the mid-70s. That's all, the whole backbone, that was it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and for a long time, since I was physically located in El Segundo, it was quite some time before we actually had literal network connectivity up to Park. And so I had a old TI Silent 700 terminal with a 300 baud acoustic modem on it, and that was my means of communicating with all the folks at Park that I was working with a Max message account, and just sending email via Max all the time.
The Max was the Max mainframe?
Max was the Max mainframe of Park. That was the main machine that was first built when Park started up.
Which we have one piece of in the Digibarn.
A piece of,
Yeah, that's a machine sort of lost to history.
Yeah, so that was my whole means of electronic communication with the guys at Park, was an old TI terminal and a 300 baud acoustic coupler.
So when I read part of the history of Star development, part of it was built on Alto, and then they gradually built the Star hardware. And
well,
they
did a Mesa emulator because Altos had the ability to load other microcode on there. So they built a Mesa emulator and microcode, and so you could actually run early Mesa code on the Alto. And then, of course, the D0s and Dandelions were built specifically as Mesa machines from the get-go to execute Mesa code. But, yeah, everything early on was all done on Altos. And it was probably only about late 79 when D0s first started getting introduced into the development group that was actually doing the Star development.
Right.
Up until then, all the development was taking place on Altos. And then once they started getting D0s and then later on prototype Dandelions, then of course they very quickly moved to doing as much of their development as they could on those platforms.
Was there ever a version of sort of the Star desktop icons and everything running on an Alto under Mesa emulation?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think they ever got to the point of having, you know, the whole system that became Star actually running on an Alto. Just there was a huge amount of stuff that needed to happen with regard to developing Pilot, which was the OS that sat underneath it.
Right.
And then all of the communications.
In fact, Ralph Kimball is in this area.
Yeah.
And he was involved.
He was involved. Well, for a long time, Ralph was actually in the Star development group, a little more of, I guess, what you would call an applications guy. And one of the things that Ralph's group worked on was a thing called CUSP.
Yes.
Which was sort of a means of non-programmer end users programming on a star in order to automate different tasks. And that was certainly one of Ralph's babies. Ralph worked really close with Charles Irby and those
Charles
guys.
Irby.
And Charles was, you know, more on the star development side, as particularly with the UI and whatnot. Dave Smith worked with him. My wife was actually the secretary in that group back
yeah.
then. So I met my wife because of Altos and Zeros and Dandelions and stuff as well.
I wrote, inspired by Cusp, I wrote a version of a macro recorder which would record all mouse movements and mm-hmm. stuff for the Elixir workstation on the DOS platform, because then we could just have all our demos completely automated, start and stop them, whatever. People could do automate tasks
yeah.
because the desktop on the Elixir workstation was totally predictable. If you moved to a certain place, it was always the same place
yeah.
relatively, and so you could automate conversion stuff, automate drag and drop.
Yeah, and as I mentioned to you before, and you were aware of, a lot of that was part of the underlying feature of the whole Metaphor system, because, you know, that was Irby and Kimball and Jochen Dallal,
right.
and then
right.
David Liddell,
and, of course,
and
yeah.
Don Massaro, and so one of the things there was you were able to take and, for instance, drop a spreadsheet into an application, drop the calculations for that spreadsheet, have it output, well, first get data from a database, drop that into a spreadsheet, do the calculations, do formatting, go through a report generator, and then have it print out all within one icon. But it was all of this, you know, essentially programming that was going on. And so all those similar kind of ideas were part of the key of Metaphor
so
system.
Metaphor really tried to take the stuff being done on Star, but bring it to a new hardware platform?
Well, and bring it to certainly to a new hardware platform, just because that's the way everything was in those days. Anything that you did, everybody was a hardware company. Even if the principal thing you were bringing to the game was clever software, everybody was a hardware company.
Yes, yeah.
And so you had to have specialized hardware. But the real thing, I think, the real point, I think, and you'd have to ask some of those other guys to get their feel, was that they were going after a different segment of the business. They weren't going after so much the quote-unquote knowledge worker who was going to
right.
do sort
right.
of desktop publishing in
the Engelbart vision
and all that
yeah.
kind of stuff. They were going more after analytical types and accountants. And we did a lot of stuff with brand management and the kinds of things that people who did brand management needed to do. And so more of the technical business user rather than the typical vanilla business user, although provided all the same sorts of tools to be able to, you know, we still had a very nice quote-unquote text editor, you know, modeless and just very, was obviously all very star-like and
so
the same
all,
kind of UI.
And it was built on what hardware platform?
It was built on 68000s, basically.
Okay, and about 1983 or
well,
so?
Well, it's they literally started up in 82. I joined Metaphor in January of 83, I think it was, and I was the 12th employee there. And that was way before we had any hardware. The only hardware we had when I joined there were Xerox Stars and a VAX.
Right. Stars with the XDE?
No, we had them mostly to just be business systems. Really.
Right.
Because at that point, they were in the process of generating huge amounts of specifications and stuff like that. And
sure.
So Star was obviously an ideal system.
Think you had like a 9700
like
or
that.
Something?
No, we just, let's see, let me try to remember the name. Oh, I think Xerox was selling the Xerox 3100 laser printer, which was a small, quote-unquote, desktop laser printer, and I think that's what we probably had, because I think that's what they were actually selling for a laser. I mean, certainly we could have gotten a 9700, but those cost millions of dollars.
Yeah. In fact, the Elixir system was designed to fill the gap. This is really interesting. The 9700 is out. Interpress drove it at a fraction of its rated speed, customers had it. They had this metacode, which was an engineering way to get into it, just test almost. Mm-hmm. And so the customers in the late 70s and early 80s built their own interfaces to drive the things at rated speed. We came in following a company called Intran, which had used the PERC. A guy named Basit Hamid, who founded Elixir later, to put all the functionality of document layout, especially forms, on a PC, so you didn't have to take down the 9700 and type away FDL, form description language, on the screen, and do a WYSIWYG environment on a machine that would put out native code, FRMs, metacodes, to drive this machine and fill the gap that the Xerox workstations couldn't do. Customers were not buying STARs or 6085s to do document design for the premier big Xerox laser printing system. They couldn't connect them.
Right.
So the business opportunity that I found myself in Bossett's company, Elixir, was, and it was a huge business, mm-hmm. because people said, I can just buy an IBM AT and put a high-res graphic card, and I can have an environment that looks like a workstation. I can draw 120 dot per inch screen, and then later on when I put the STAR look and feel on it, it had a nice workstation feeling to it, even though it was sort of mice running on treadmills underneath.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
it was just DOS underneath. It was not multitasked.
Yeah.
But GEM, we used GEM and Graphic Environment Manager, but it felt like a workstation sure. running on a regular old platform, even on the laptops, the early Amber laptops. And that was the whole business was built on this gap the Xerox never filled.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, and there were quite a few of those.
Quite a few of those. We lived in the spaces in between the bad business decisions.
And still do in a lot of ways. It's really interesting how a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about, some of it isn't really commonplace quite yet.
Yeah.
And other pieces of it, you know, have just become a little more commonplace over the last few years. And there are still pieces that aren't even out there yet.
I think the consistency of the STAR interface, where an icon represents a printer in another domain, and you have mm-hmm. little codings on that icon that tell you its status
yeah.
and its accessibility.
And the whole thing, one of the beauties of the STAR system was the whole overall system, the Xerox network system, and all of the different types of servers and services, and how all of those were managed and interacted and passed messages back and forth to each other. Some of that stuff still isn't around. Others of that is finally just now kind of coming around in terms of things that, for instance, Active Directory does and LDAP and some stuff like that is all stuff that the Xerox Clearinghouse and the Xerox network system
20 years
had
ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah, and it, one of the...
And the ability to from Palo Alto, drop a document onto a printer that's physically located in Rochester and have it print, and things like that.
Yeah, and one of the purposes of the DigiBarn is taking people through and running systems and showing them, this is what existed 20, 22 years ago, and, you know, it's... not measurably different, really, in terms of the size and the power it draws and all that sort of mm-hmm. stuff, but it really, it's been $1 trillion spent, Moore's Law going up the curve, and yet the thing you're sitting in front of today still is missing a few of the things that this system had.
Right.
Reinvented not once, but twice.
Yeah.
Maybe in the Unix world, in the Mac world, and in the Windows world, invented over and over again from scratch, basically.
Yeah.
And the only real benefit was a crowd of people like you guys that moved from companies to company and bringing some of that knowledge, like Charles Simony to Tomorrow,
yeah.
who brought Bravo to Microsoft
yeah,
Word.
Absolutely. Yeah, and obviously that's happened a lot over time. And for every big version of that, like Bravo to Word and Interpress to PostScript and, you know, Adobe and Grid and, you know, some of the big examples.
Note-taker to Osborne.
There are 100 smaller examples that
FTP
sort of really got to look for, but they're there.
Yeah, in fact, we have a diagram, this bushy tree thing
on
the site.
Wonderful.
Did you see that?
Yeah,
we're trying to extend that
and
show the – it's hard to tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think I'll stop it here. But thanks a lot.
Yeah, I guess we better start.